Welcome, and thank you for standing by. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you very much, Ashley. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the PPSAI call on the 6th of May, 2014. On the call today, we have Graham Bunton, Tatiana Komtsova, Val Sherman, James Liddell, Holly Reich, Steve Metalitz, Sarah Wild, Maria Farrell, John Horton, Phil Morano, Kathy Kleiman, Luke Soyser, Tim Weiss, Justin Macy, Laura Jadid, Michael Page, David Heasley, Christian Dawson, Jim Bykoff, Griffin Barnett, and Stephanie Perrin. We have apologies from Amir Sadeh, Robbie Estey, Suzanne Prosser, and Don Blumenthal. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Amy Behrens, Joe Catapano, and myself, Natalie Pergwin. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. I note that Alice Deacon has just joined the Adobe Connect room. Thank you very much, and over to you, Graham.
Thank you very much, Natalie. We've got the roll call in the SOI done. Does anybody have any questions about today's proposed agenda before we move forward with that? The gentle plan is to continue discussion of the threshold question for Category C, and we'll discuss that as long as it seems to be fruitful, and then we may move on to actual Category C question one, and maybe even possibly, if that goes well, into Category C question two. So to backtrack a little bit and make sure everybody's on the same page, we had some of this discussion last week, and please feel free to chime in if I'm characterizing this incorrectly. But we had a relatively divided camp of parties on this, where some people felt that there was no point in distinguishing between commercial and non-commercial, and there were people that wanted to dig into this. It got a little heated. Apologies were offered. But what we want to do today is, I think, dig into some of those questions that were raised, and from the people who really wanted to dig into them, I hope we're going to hear some of their sort of proposed answers or solutions to these questions that we raised. So unless there's anything else, let's get into it. So maybe perhaps it's best to first reiterate the threshold question, which we phrased as: currently proxy and privacy services are available to companies, non-commercial organizations, and individuals. Should there be any change to this aspect of the current system in the new accreditation standards? That raises all sorts of issues. And we've got James Pladel in the queue already, so perhaps, James, if you wanted to kick this off, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thanks, Graham. James speaking. And just a question. We keep referring to this as a threshold question, and I'm wondering if we could be more descriptive, because I actually thought we were talking about something else. I've been referring to this as an eligibility test or an eligibility question or something like that. I don't know if it makes any sense. If the group is set on calling this a threshold question, then I'll just lower my hand and shut up. But I felt like it was kind of confusing or ambiguous, and I was just going to offer the idea that we call it something else. Thanks.
Steve?
Yeah, Steve Metalitz here.
Was it on that?
I'm not sure it matters what we call it, but I think the reason it's posed this way is that the answer to it may determine the answers to the next couple of questions. And specifically, if the answer to the question is no, there shouldn't be any change to who can use a privacy proxy service, let's put it that way, then the next couple of questions either become irrelevant or less, more peripheral, let's put it that way, because they're all directed to how do you distinguish between commercial, non-commercial, individual, entity, and so forth. So that, I think that's why it's called a threshold question. I would defer to the authors of the question, but I think that's what's meant by that.
Thank you, Steve. This is Graham. That tends to be my understanding of you know the nomenclature there as well. Kathy?
just stepping in very quickly, good morning all, to agree with Steve that it is, that the idea was when we were adopting this as part of kind of the working group planning of the questions that we might not need to talk about some of the more detailed questions of differentiations among categories of users if there's general agreement that we don't want that differentiation. So that's the thought, but James, feel free to call it anything you'd like, and whatever makes it make more sense as kind of an initial question and an evaluatory, something like that question. Thanks, Graham.
Thanks, Kathy. James?
Thanks, Graham. So based on the explanations from Kathy and Steve, it makes a lot more sense now why we're calling it that, and I will withdraw the proposal that we rename it. but thanks for that.
All right. Thanks, James. So maybe we can get this going a little bit with perhaps one of the more focused sub-questions here around this threshold, which is, you know, what is commercial versus non-commercial? If we want to make the distinction, how do we begin to define those differences? And I'm looking here to is I don't think Kieran is on the call. Perhaps someone who is on board for ensuring that we have that distinction could talk to this.
This is John Horton with LegitScript. I can go ahead and raise my hand, or I can just start talking. I think there's been a couple of ideas thrown around. One that I personally think may be difficult to implement is to look at the status of the registrant. Are they registered as a corporate entity, or are they not? I think that probably is actually not helpful and is difficult. Where I think some of the thinking, and I don't want to speak for Kieran, but we've talked about this a little bit, is to really look at not only the use of the domain name, but mostly the specific question of whether payments are processed for a good or a service, either within the website itself, or is, I'm sure we've all seen before, sometimes you have what's called sort of the affiliate marketing or the sales website, but it directs to yet another website to process the payment. That would be a common sense test. But, in that analysis, it really wouldn't matter whether the registrant was a commercial entity or not. The registrar the privacy and proxy service provider would not really need to look at the status. It would just be a question of, is a good or is a service being sold on the website? I am sure there are potentially some other ideas, maybe even better ideas, about how to make that distinction. But as we've talked about this, it has seemed like that is the cleanest way to approach it if, in fact, there were going to be such a distinction between commercial and non-commercial. At least that's one idea.
Okay. Thanks, John. Tim?
That sounds simple, but it's really not, because when someone registers a domain name and it's not always or wants to have privacy, it's not always on an existing in-use domain name that you can go and check the content. If content in use were even in ICANN's purview, which I would argue that it's not, but then so if it's a new domain name, how do we? So everyone who registers a new domain name gets privacy, and then we have to monitor it down the road so that if they decide to use it for commercial purposes, then we remove it. So that creates an enforcement issue that I think a road we have not gone down for some time, unless John's implying that it's not something that ICANN has to check or that registrars have to check. We just have to respond at a later date if someone happens to report it or complain or whatever. And then I'm not sure that it really serves a purpose in that regard. So I guess I'm still confused about how that simplifies things. And then the other thing is that, charitable organizations at times take contributions online. So does that, so then we have to distinguish between, someone taking payments for profit versus taking payments for nonprofit. So no matter how simple this sounds, it's very, very complicated.
Tim, great questions. And I was just typing. I don't want to jump the queue. I think a couple other people have their hand up, but maybe if I can just respond to those points quickly and then I'll be quiet. So I think first, you know, the background point about whether the use of a domain name is in sort of ICANN's and registrar's purview, and I know there's been a lot of discussions about this over the years, and I think, you know, various people feel different ways. What I would note is in the 2013 RAA, Section 3.18 certainly does impose some requirements on registrars to respond to abuse notifications based on the use of the domain name, so I would argue that that is already something that there is some precedent about now under the 2013 REA about there being some circumstances where use needs to be considered. Tim, I would totally agree with you. I do not think it would be reasonable for a registrar to have to actively monitor for whether a any domain name with the registrar is being actively used for commercial purposes. It seems best and simplest for it to be responsive, for example, if you receive a complaint. And I think the other thing that could happen is maybe it's a little bit like the WHOIS accuracy requirements, where when a registrant registers a domain name, and as you correctly point out, they may not know at the time, are they going to use it for commercial purposes or not, they are simply, you know, notified with a little pop-up on the screen. If you're going to use this for commercial purposes, you know, please be advised you can't use the privacy and or proxy service. And then, you know, as with WHOIS accuracy and a lot of other terms and conditions, the registrant needs to be trusted that they are going to adhere to that. And then if the registrar receives a complaint, I would actually argue it's even easier to verify than, for example, a falsified or an inaccurate WHOIS, which, you know, having talked to registrars before, I understand there's maybe some cases where it's pretty easy to verify that, but in some cases, you know, how do you know? Does this address exist or not? This would be a pretty simple test. It would be, you know, is there something being sold or, you know, a good or a service via the domain name? So, you know, as we get into some of these other questions, which I think are important, like what about a charitable organization? That may be a little bit more in the weeds than maybe I should respond to now. I think you're right. It's a really important question, but I think that those questions can be resolved, even if we don't necessarily get into the details on that right now. So hopefully I answered the questions that I think you just posed, and if not, let me know. And then I know other people probably want to weigh in as well, so I'll stop there.
Thanks, John. James?
Thanks, Graham, and I think Tim, this is James speaking to the transcript, and Tim covered some of the things that I wanted to raise regarding the difficulty in determining use, and then, of course, we just keep continuing to presume that it's a web, the domain name is being used for web services, but certainly could be used for email or apps, mobile apps, or you know, other types of services maybe that haven't been developed or deployed or yet. So I think we need to maybe keep our options open. But I wanted to perhaps throw out an idea. I think it's building on what John raised here about the registrars have a duty to investigate reports of abuse, and I think that is correct, and that is sufficiently vague as to allow, I think, both you know, both the service providers and those reporting, you know, some flexibility in what constitutes abuse and what the registrar should do based on, you know, their jurisdiction, their terms of service, et cetera. And you know, if the ultimate destination for this thread is that we're going to have something similar in an accreditation program where an accredited privacy proxy service has to investigate claims of abuse, I think that's, you know, probably not unreasonable. But I just wanted to perhaps put out for the group something I was thinking about this morning, which is this idea of a three-point test on this question, which if we acknowledge, for example, and I'll be quick, I'm sorry, but if we acknowledge that the status quo today is that you can use these services for this type of use and that there are no restrictions, then I think that the burden, to some extent, is on those proposing to change that for the tens of millions of people who use these people and organizations who use these services, that before their products or services that they've purchased or might lose, changes, that we need to demonstrate a compelling case that that there is a clear harm occurring with the status quo, and that harm can only, that harm outweighs fixing that harm outweighs any sort of inconvenience or disruption to the folks, the millions of the customers and users that currently have these services. And then finally, that this is the only way to solve those harms. I think we have to make sure, this is kind of the Hippocratic Oath or whatever test to this problem, is that we have to demonstrate the status quo is completely unacceptable, and this is the only way to solve it before we yank the rug out from under that existing user base. And I would like to put that out to the group as something that we should consider when we're talking about building any new restrictions into these services that don't exist currently. Thank you.
That's interesting. Thanks, James. Stephanie? Stephanie, you appear to be muted. There you go.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yep.
It's my. Oh, very good. Okay. James just made some of my points. We have been kind of beating this one to death in the EWG group, and I understand that just because we're going to come down from the Ten Commandments in June doesn't mean you folks have to listen to what we've come up with. But I do get a sense of deja vu. I guess I'd like to make about three points. The first one is that this is, I would say, extremely difficult to implement because of legal persons and the difficulty in figuring out who's selling a commercial, selling off the Internet. The evolutionary nature of the Internet at this point, where all kinds of people may be doing small things from their websites, and, we can hardly come up with some preemptive strike to stop that right now. But I wanted to come back on a point that James made. We have a risk. We have an identified risk that you're going to be dealing with someone who's abusing the privilege of a privacy proxy service, right? We're working on an expedited takedown. We're working on reveals. We're working on processes that hopefully will deal with that risk. So we don't need every single possible, I'm forgetting the word for how you look after a risk, explored in this round. We try a couple of them. You have an expedited system now that's going to work. You don't need a preemptive. Anybody that could possibly be using a website for commercial services is not entitled to a privacy proxy service remedy. You don't. Now let's see how the other ones work, because we're moving from a system that really doesn't work at all to something that I hope is going to provide you a reveal when there's a bona fide case. And that's my next concern, is that we wind up with a whole pile of semi-spurious reveal cases for reasons that are not necessarily valid, that are just exploratory and are not necessarily valid abuse cases. How do we deal with that risk? Thanks. I think that's it.
Thank you, Stephanie, and I see an agreement there from Holly. Kathy bounced herself out of the queue, so I think you ended up at the back. Let's go to, I think that's Mike Pelage.
Yes, Mike Pelage. Thanks. I just wanted to follow up, Tim, on some of your comments, and while I agree with what some of the fundraising that nonprofits do, I do think ICANN is changing. I know you and I have been around for a while, but when you look at this current round of new GTLDs and the use restrictions that are hard-coded into many of the registration agreements and how ICANN are going to be required to enforce them, I do think there kind of is a fundamental paradigm shift from back, say, 2000 when, you know, ICANN and most registrars were really just administering databases. Whether we like it or not, I think there is a growing realization that the use of a domain name is quickly entering into day-to-day decision-making. And whether that crosses over into some of our discussions, I just think it's important to note that historical evolution within the namespace. Thanks.
Can I respond just briefly? This is Tim Ruiz. I don't disagree completely, Michael. The issue, though, is that we're talking about individual TLDs who could, if they decide, push, well, like .us, which is a ccTLD. We don't allow privacy or proxy registrations. So, you know, those gTLDs could certainly do the same thing. Based on what their use is. But, you know, a new gTLD that has, you know, a restricted use from the outset is different than doing something like a add-on service or whatever you want to call it, privacy and proxy services are. It's not exactly the term I'm looking for, but it's been in place for nearly a decade. And now to say, oh, well, we're going to back out, you know, the millions of users who have been using it perfectly legitimately for all this time, they're no longer eligible. You know, we need to identify what the problem is that we're trying to solve and also ask ourselves, you know, expanding ICANN's purview in this particular case, does it really make sense? And I guess that's where I'm at. I haven't heard any argument that says it makes sense.
And so Mike Pelage again. So again, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to take a look at again the changing ecosystem. And to your point, Tim, let's look at the picks which were basically mandated on all TLDs. So this was all the new TLDs. This was not something that registry operators voluntarily did. This was something that was mandated by the GAC and ICANN and said, you will all do this. And some of them go to use. Are you engaged in fraud and a number of other broad things, which I think we're still waiting to see how that evolves. But what's important here, Tim, and this is something that if you look at some of the work we did when we did with the fee tasting component where it was first Aphilius and Neustar that did the RCEPs and then how that became the basis of a consensus policy, what happens, right, if some of these PIC requirements that are now in the, you know, now the majority of gTLDs, do they get imposed on the legacy gTLDs? And again, when you begin to impose these on the legacy gTLDs, you now have ICANN starting down, whether we like it or not, it appears,
you know,
that ICANN is
Michael, I think
down.
The point is that no one is saying that we can't say, well, if you have a privacy and proxy service, you can't. Maybe we should impose the idea that, well, if you're engaged in fraudulent activities and blah, 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 you're going to lose it. That's one thing. But what we're saying is, well, when you're engaged in a perfectly legitimate legal operation, now we're going to get into what you're doing and tell you can't do things. That's the difference. And I don't see where we've backed off from that anywhere. You know, ICANN doesn't determine what's fraudulent. But we have to respond to such things. That's a whole different story than to say, well, it's a perfectly legitimate thing, and now we're going to start getting into what people are legitimately doing with their websites.
Okay. Thanks, gentlemen. Just a note, let's make sure we're queuing. I think people like John Horton have now been waiting for quite some time to speak.
Oh, hey, thank you, Steve.
John?
This is John Horton again, and again, my apologies if I'm taking up too much of the oxygen on this call. But James, really thoughtful way, I think, to present what I think you referred to as a three-part test. And I wanted to offer sort of a different point of view on some of those comments. I think, and James, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you sort of said part of what you were saying is that the burden would be on those who would propose to make a change from the current system in which commercial entities are allowed to use privacy or proxy services. The burden would be on those of us who propose that to justify why that's needed. Let me actually turn that around and suggest that actually offering privacy and proxy services to commercial entities is the change from from what exists in the offline world and has for a long time, preceding the Internet itself. As we have tried to take a look at what are entities engaged in the sale of goods or services around the world are required to do in terms of their registration, disclosing their location, their identity, and so forth. And look, just as a side note, I understand the Internet is different from the offline world. We can't always make the argument that we should, you know, reflect the way that things work in the offline world on the Internet, but just to make this point, I'm not aware of any jurisdiction in which a seller of goods and services is able to conceal their identity, their location. I mean, it's sort of a truism that obviously if you have a brick-and-mortar merchant, by definition, the customer can, you know, walk in, see where they are, and obviously see the identity of the merchant. But, you know, the principle that I think exists pretty much everywhere, at least as far as I can tell, is that an entity that is engaged in the sale of goods and services needs to register, to be transparent. And, you know, part of the reason for that, obviously, is consumer protection. And, you know, I think that sometimes, you know, those of us either in the registrar world or those of us who work with registrars a lot, you know, tend to see sort of Internet policy through the prism of looking at what do registrants need, since those are the, you know, a lot of the folks that we deal with. But, of course, registrants are only one type of Internet user. They're greatly outnumbered, I would suggest, by the vast number of Internet users who never register a domain name, but, in fact, use the Internet for information and for often buying goods or services. And I would argue that just as offline, those Internet users have the right to be able to have some transparency into the identity and the location of the business that they are dealing with, that should be reflected on the Internet. And so the point I'm making is I think that if you look at what is required of sellers of goods and services in the longer term, offering the ability to conceal in a whois record their, you know, identity and location is actually more of a change in a historical sense.
Thanks, John. Kathy, you've been waiting very patiently.
Great, thank you. But I also like the give and take. I like when people get back on and kind of there's a little more debate, so I guess because I was an old debater. So thanks, Graham. I like it, both combinations. The word conceal is such a loaded term. Sorry, John, it just is. I thought, and that's why I bounced the cue, was to go back and look at some of our prior work, but I swear we came to the conclusion that, as a working group, that registration of a proxy privacy service in and of itself is not a stigma, is not an admission of guilt, is not an admission of wrongdoing, and that we came to that conclusion on behalf of all existing users, commercial, non-commercial, individual. So to hear that I have a website. I raise money. It's an educational research website, and I raise money to make the ENIAC Programmers documentary, which, by the way, is made and going to the Seattle International Film Festival later this month. So I just share that with everybody. But there were donations. They were handled by a third party. And so the idea that I would have to reveal my home address in order to raise money to do the historical work and the role model work that I do with women in technology is kind of crazy. So let me review a few points that I'm seeing. One is that Tim raised the question last week, why? Why are we looking at this? And I think we got the answer this week. The reason we're looking at it is to eliminate a class or category of current registrants, which would fall somewhat under the quote-unquote commercial, and it sounds like commercial would be expanded to anyone who takes donations, dollars and cents. There might be differentiation, but it'll take us a long time to get to that. The second is that there is a stigma associated with proxy privacy registration for commercial entities, and that somehow you're concealing your identity by not wanting to show where your Planned Parenthood clinic is, or that national laws that require, you know, in Germany, you're required to put your name and your address and contact information on the homepage of a trading site, that somehow those are insufficient. And so I want to take us back to the threshold question. Is there a consensus for us to move to this type of detail, to this type of differentiation of categories of goods and services, or are we still at the place where we think most users, most registrants are good, which seems to be where we were the last week or so, are good, they're using this for legitimate purposes, as the WHOIS review team found, and that we really – have to get show that there's a problem that needs to be solved in order to go past where we are now. Thanks, Graham.
Thank you, Kathy. Stephanie? Stephanie, are you muted? You're definitely...
Hey, can you hear me now?
Can hear you now. Thank you.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. Kathy made the threshold point, which I think needs to be reiterated. Why would we move to this? Is there a compelling need? To get back to the question of whether ICANN has already started down the slippery slope of international regulatory activity, just because there's something in the RAA does not mean that that camel's nose under the tent means that ICANN should jump in with both feet and determine that it is the body through the control of the domain name system that should be setting out the regulatory requirements for people doing business or having any kind of commercial purpose on the Internet. And I think that's a really critical point. If we see this as an engine for growth in developing countries, who is ICANN to determine what's consumer protection in small African countries, for instance? Are they well presented on this call? I would suggest not. If there are women doing education and tutoring in a country that doesn't allow girls to go to school, are you going to make them expose themselves and expose themselves to harm? I think this is unacceptable. We have other mitigations that we are busy instituting to solve the risks that various of our members have eloquently expressed. Let's try those mitigations before we start tackling a really difficult problem in determining who's an enterprise and who isn't, who's in commercial activity and who isn't. I think it's an insoluble problem unless you are going to load a massive front end to getting a domain name. And I don't think we have the mandate to start talking about a massive new front end for the privilege of getting a domain name on the Internet. I don't see it in our terms of reference. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metalitz. I think we're shedding some light more than heat here, which I think is great. I'm drawing 4 points from the conversation so far, which I'd like to put out there and see if people agree. First is we don't seem to be talking about what I would call ex ante or a threshold requirement here. I think John put that off the table to begin with. So in other words, you wouldn't, if you wanted to be a proxy, to have a proxy registration, you would not be denied because you were a company or because you have LLC after your name or Inc. or Limited or something like that. So I think we're talking solely about people that are using the domain name for a particular purpose, and that's where obviously there's a lot of questions about what that purpose is. But we're not talking about an ex ante. We're talking about something that would, in effect, allow you to be kicked out of the program if you violated it. So that's the first point I'd make. Second, I think I just want to emphasize that we're not talking about what a privacy or proxy service might do voluntarily. Some services now have a prohibition on commercial activity. I think I remember we had that presentation a couple of weeks ago from some of the services, and I assume we're not talking about forbidding that. We're just talking about whether it would be mandatory to have to restrict the eligibility or to make people that are using the domain name for commercial purposes inapplicable, so ineligible. So I wanted to put that out there as well. Third, on, in terms of the change in the status quo, yes, that's correct, but there are going to be a lot of changes in the status quo as a result of any accreditation program. So let's not exaggerate what the burden should be. I agree the burden should be on those who think the answer to this threshold question should be yes, there should be a change. But let's not, I think we have to be careful not to overstate it. And my last point is I would basically agree with, I think Stephanie said this and others. At this point, I'm not persuaded that being engaged in commercial activity by itself should be a mandatory reason for ineligibility for a proxy or privacy registration. I get it that in many countries that is the law, or at least certainly the bias would be against that. But I think because of the practical difficulties that several people have talked about, I think from my perspective anyway, I don't think that burden has been met yet. Thank you.
Thanks for your summary, Steve. Those are interesting points. Tim?
Yes. The idea that certain governments, or jurisdictions require commercial entities to reveal who they are so that people who are doing business with them know who they are. That is a perfectly legitimate thing. I personally wouldn't do business online with somebody I couldn't figure out who they were. But when even me, with everything I know about ICANN and who is and all that, when I'm looking to find out, who I'm dealing with, I don't look at who is. What I look at is on the web, what's on the website, and on the Contact Us page or About Us page or those kinds of things. And I think that's where most users look. And I think that when you talk about these laws or requirements in different jurisdictions, in most cases, that's what they're talking about. That on the website, these companies have to reveal who they are in some extent, but that doesn't necessarily correlate to what's in the who is. There's a lot of sole proprietorships, mom and pops, if you will, in various countries that, what they may want in their who is to be so that they're contactable 24 hours a day to make sure, they don't lose their domain name. They might have their cell phone number. They might have their personal home address. That might be one thing. What they want to put on their website and display to the people they're doing business with might be another. And it has nothing to do with trying to obfuscate who they are. It's just that's a reality of life and doing business in the world today, that you may not want to have both, but that both may not necessarily be the same thing. So I don't think, having privacy and proxy services on a domain name necessarily negates them fulfilling that requirement in jurisdictions that have it. So, but in the end, I agree with Steve that I think so far we've heard really nothing that says that there's any, overriding reason why we should distinguish between commercial and non-commercial entities as far as privacy and proxy services go. And then just finally, I don't think anyone is saying, I haven't heard anyone say yet, that if a privacy or proxy customer is engaging in abusive, fraudulent, illegal activities, that they should somehow be able to keep their privacy or proxy. It's not likely. They'll even get to keep their domain name. That's already dealt with. And if that's going to flow down to privacy and privacy services, I don't think anybody would argue with that. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. We've got to go to James, but we might close the queue after this unless there's anybody who feels urgently in need. I think we're getting near the end of this conference. And also, I feel that John Harden is probably a bit better. So, James?
Thanks, Graham. Pretty bad echo there. I don't know if somebody's got to mute if you're not speaking, please. Thank you. Okay. So I wasn't going to jump into the queue, but I wanted to respond to two points were made, one by Kathy, one by Steve. Just in general, Steve, I agree with you that we need to make sure that we understand the distinction between commercial activity versus abusive commercial activity. I think, banning all commercial activity is kind of like shutting down a marketplace because there are some pickpockets running around. I think that that's a a blunt approach to what is, in effect, a problem that needs a more targeted solution. I did want to disagree, however, with Steve's point about the status quo. I think the status quo has to have some standing and some inertia when we have these policy discussions, particularly when we have, as I've indicated, millions, if not tens of millions, of unrepresented consumers of these services that are, that will be affected, materially affected, and to some extent may have offline repercussions if they were to lose this privacy service. And I think that, so in this particular case, and maybe it's just a subject matter, but I think the status quo does need to be given a fairly significant degree of respect, because if we talk about unveiling someone's identity that currently enjoys a protection, that is pretty serious. I wanted to come back and circle back and reinforce what Kathy was saying about the stigma associated with by using words like conceal or hide. I think that that is not serving our debate. I think that there is no more stigma associated with use of a privacy or proxy service that there would be with obtaining an unlisted telephone number, a P.O. box, or paying for a purchase at a grocery store using cash instead of a credit card. I think that there's, a legitimate desire to not necessarily want to, throw your breadcrumbs into the, into the big data machine and always leave footprints and fingerprints everywhere you go, whether it's online or off. And I wanted to kind of just, listening to some of the discussions about commercial use, I realized that what we're really talking about here, I think a couple of folks raised this, is, when an online transaction goes south, whether it was, disagreement between the two parties in good faith, or whether it was genuine fraud or deception was involved, I think that, we would be overburdening the domain name system to, try to address some of those issues when, in fact, those are probably more correctly targeted to the payment, whoever's processing that payment, whether it's a because you can't exchange cash. Even bitcoins are, clunky online and all those virtual currencies. We need to be focusing a lot of this discussion on, how someone gets a, redresses a transaction like that, or harms that are occurring through credit card processors or online payment systems or payment platforms. I think all of those probably are closer to this issue than the privacy service who's affiliated with a registrar, who's affiliated with a web host, who feels like maybe two or three steps removed from a bad transaction. So just putting those in the queue, and I agree. I'll drop now, but I wanted to echo some of those statements that were made earlier. Thanks.
Thanks, James. I was sort of thinking that it might be useful as we try and get a sense of what the consensus is on this particular issue. If when people are speaking, they could sort of indicate whether this is the perspective of their stakeholder group or their constituency, so we can sort of see how broad that opinion is, if possible. Thank you. Holly?
Thank you, Holly Raich, for the record. I tend to agree with Stephanie, with Kathy. I think... certainly my experience with Stephanie and Kathy is we have been privacy advocates. At the same time, I have not heard how, in fact, you're going to differentiate amongst commercial users. If we're talking about a commercial user, it could be a girls' school in Uganda. It could be Woolies. It could be anybody. And, in fact, in some of those situations, privacy proxy is absolutely critical. So how we draw the line is a critical issue facing this group, and I don't know how we can do it realistically. Even if it's post-ante, I don't know how we can do it. And I would strongly urge we go with what Stephanie's saying, which is it really is too hard, whether it's this group or the EWG. So the next step, which is what do we do about it? How quickly do we respond? Do we take away the domain name? Those are the issues that we ought to be worrying about, because I really am not sure that we're going to be meaningfully engaged in conversation when we haven't come up with a way that, even if we can pretend that there is some stigma, and I agree with Kathy, there isn't, what can we do about it realistically? And if we can't, let's just move on to another question. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly. Maria?
Hi, thank you. Can everyone hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Super, thank you. Sorry about that. Just great. Yeah, I just want to sum up really what I think some of my constituency and people with the privacy concerns have really in that in trying to make a distinction between commercial and non-commercial uses of a domain name, you know, I think we kind of discovered that commercial uses are not inherently troublesome or stigmatized, and in that trying to go after a class of registration rather than a type of behavior, we're really, you know, we're solving a problem that doesn't exist. The question of whether people who are offering a service or taking money on the internet can hide their activity, and for example, in Germany, they're required to put it all online. It's a bit of a non sequitur because the actual legislation that's being referred to there is the e-commerce directive, which does require all service providers to provide their contact details on their websites. But of course, you also have the data protection directive, which is, you know, in law and in practice, we're able to make something of a distinction between those two types of actors. But of course, the problem is that when we're using the WHOIS to try and do that, it's a really, really blunt instrument. So it's really it's very much, even within the Canadian context, too complex to try and distinguish between the types of uses, the intention of use that people have. So I think when we do that, we create lots of unintended consequences, right? And that's the girls' school in Uganda or the Planned Parenthood centres. And so I think when we try to almost stigmatize a class of registrations rather than a type of illegal or unwanted activity, we're basically throwing out a huge big fishing net, you know, trying to catch tuna, but we're actually catching a lot of dolphins in it. So I think it's really, you know, I think for all of those reasons, I think certainly on the non-commercial stakeholders constituency, you know, all our input and all the research and background we have in this shows it's a really it's a poorly thought out policy that would just create be too difficult to implement and create unintended consequences. I just want to hark back very quickly to when we were in Singapore, we did have some discussion about whether people who use their lawyer, a legal attorney, as their effective proxy should be included. And, you know, I think if we were to include all commercial types of activity as people who shouldn't be allowed to have a proxy service provided to them, we should really double down and go really hard against the attorneys providing this service, because it's hard to imagine very many attorneys providing that service for clients that are not doing so for commercial reasons. So I think once you actually look at that, this threshold question, I think it creates a lot more difficulty than it resolves. That's really it.
Thank you very much, Maria. Stephanie, last thought on this, perhaps briefly?
Yes, and I apologize for abusing the microphone repeatedly. My point was to respond to the point that someone raised, I'm sorry, I forget who, that when you are engaged in commercial activity, you have to provide your data. You have to register as a business or something. The difference is, in most circumstances, for small business, there are means to limit the distribution of your identity. So I could be running a small business without being incorporated, selling quilts. Even if I were operating off a farm, my farm information would be registered through farm data, not necessarily put out there for all to behold, so that if I were selling my products through a farm market, I would not necessarily be identifiable to every Tom, Dick, and Harry who wanted to show up at the gate. This is normal, and it is the needs of small business, I think, that the NCSG is also protecting under its umbrella of privacy. There's anti-competitive reasons. There's all kinds of reasons to protect small business, including privacy of the individuals engaged in commerce.
Thanks, Stephanie. We got a lot of interesting discussion in there. I think we heard an awful lot from the awful is probably the wrong adjective to use. A lot of interesting points from the no, we should not distinguish between these two types camp, and that was very good. And thank you to John Horton for standing up for the other side and maintaining that position, because that's interesting. We are looking forward to that. I would encourage the yes camp to this threshold question to perhaps engage a bit more on the list, and we can see some of their specific examples and solutions to the problems that have been raised here, so that if we need to discuss that anymore, we can do that there. We're running a bit short of time because we need to discuss briefly the how we're going to set up the subgroup that we've discussed previously. Maybe we should do that now before we run out of time. Mary, would you be so kind?
Sure, Graham. Hi, everybody. It's Mary with ICANN staff. This refers to the subgroup that was going to deal with an issue that came out of the Category B question 3, which is whether there was a practical way to make sure that in doing a transfer or restoration, for example, that a registrant or a beneficiary doesn't actually lose the privacy proxy service. And we did have a few volunteers to do that. So to the extent that staff can help you with a bridge number for a call, for example, please let us know. If not, then I think what the chairs would like to see is probably something sent to the list within a reasonably short period of time so that it can be discussed further or have some conclusions made. This is the same sort of task that in other working groups we've had a few people go off and do work on a specific question like this one, and it's proven quite effective. So hopefully we can see some suggestions forthcoming from the little group, and what I can do is follow up with those folks who volunteered and see how we can help you make that happen.
Thanks, Mary. I think James wanted to respond to that.
Hi, Graham. James speaking, and had some discussions. Kathy and I were tasked to take a look at this question and not necessarily address the question, but put together an approach we didn't want to use the word charter, but just a description or an outline of what the sub-team specifically would be asked to address. We worked on this on Friday, a little bit over the weekend, and Kathy was very diligent in capturing a lot of the notes from our discussion, and of course I got overwhelmed and completely dropped the ball in time for this call. So I would say that to the group that our work is ongoing, I think that we have identified some specific issues relative to transfers, renewals, and other functions where the privacy proxy service is acting as a critical intermediary on these issues. And, I think in some cases the answer could be as simple as requiring the service to relay ICANN critical communications, of certain type, like who is data reminders and renewals and transfer authorizations. And some of them get a little more complicated, particularly when we talk about transfers, because, I think that what we have identified is that when we talk about what we're calling tentatively a protected transfer or a private transfer, there are really four cases. There's the status quo today, where the information is public at the beginning of the transfer and it's public afterwards. There's this idea that a domain name would transfer to a new registrar, but either stay with the same privacy service or move to the other registrar's affiliated privacy service. And then there are all these scenarios in between where, the domain name might be unprotected on one end, but move into a protected state after the transfer, or vice versa. And so I think that we need to, make sure that we capture all of these and that the working group, the sub-team that's going to address these, looks at them discreetly, because they will have, I think, different sequences and different procedures for exchanging that information to ensure that the desires or the intent of the use case is upheld. So it's very tricky, and it's just something that we need to think about a little bit more. So that's my update to the group. I'm sure Kathy probably has more that she might want to add, because I think she's probably been contributing more of the substantive material than I have been to this effort. Not to put her on the spot or anything, but she's been carrying me in this effort. So
I don't know. I don't know who's carrying who. can I follow up really fast, Graham? I see someone's in the queue. I don't want to cut Tim off. What James is talking about, to let everybody know, we're looking for two kinds of concepts. One is that we're changing nothing about the transfer policy. This is about kind of working within the existing rules of the transfer policy to preserve information and choice as people are transferring domain names, or in the case of a failing registrar or a registrar that's lost accreditation. So this is just kind of about plugging holes, and we'll get back to you very shortly because I think we've determined where they are, and we'll get back and see if we can kind of easily plug some holes with information and choice in the context of the existing transfer policy, because we're not going to change that, of course. But thanks to James for the more detailed summary. It's perfect, and again, we'll be reporting back shortly.
Thank you, Kathy. Tim, you have 1 minute.
I just heard James say required in part of his update. I was just concerned because I thought we had already pretty much agreed as a group that we weren't going to, that this wasn't going to be a required service, but something that was going to be looked at as a potential best practice. And that, you know, the transfers is a different issue than a failed registrar, at least in the way I look at it. So that's the only concern I had, in that we weren't going to hold up the working group's progress while we wait for this subgroup. And I take it we haven't been, so I would assume that that's not going to happen as we go forward either.
Sounds like James is saying that he misspoke and that it's not required. And it also doesn't, from the chat, look like we're going to be holding up the working group any. Maria, I'm assuming that's an old hand. And that brings us just about to the end of the time we've got today. Next steps, next meeting, so we've got this little subgroup working away, which is great. Next week, I think we've had enough discussion on that threshold question. I think we've got a pretty solid sense of where people are. If there is more to be said, please say it on the list, especially from the Yes camp. It would be very good to hear from you there. If not, I think next week we're actually going to be digging into Category C Question 1, possibly also 2 and 3, given, I think, the clarity that we've got on our threshold question. So unless there's anything else, I think that brings us to the hour.
Graham, if we agreed on the threshold question, why would we be going into Category C Question 1?
I think we just need to check the box is what I'm suggesting.
Because I think it's a leapfrog over Category C Question 1, but I guess we should talk about it on the list.
Yep.
Sure. Cool. I'm saying we're talking about Category C Question 1. We're not jumping past it. We're going to, you know, we've talked about the threshold question. We're going to move on to the actual questions within there.
But that's exactly it. If there's consensus that we don't create categories of goods and services, why would we go into the questions that create categories of goods and services?
This is John Horton. Maybe we could
it wasn't really a
hold off and make sure there's a consensus. I know there's a lot of voices on one side on this call, but I think there might be other members of the working group that may want to weigh in, and you know, maybe we'll end up the answer being no, but maybe we could just give it a little bit more of a chance there.
Sure. This is hence why the encouragement on the list. I don't want to – so we can take this to the list, too, whether we actually have to go in and check those boxes of these are the questions we were given. We've answered this threshold question. We can move past them or not. I'm not sure offhand whether we can do just that. But I don't want to take anybody else over past time. So we can continue those discussions on the list. Thank you, everyone, for participating. Have a good week.
Thanks, Graham.
Hey, thanks, Graham.
Cheers.
Thanks, Graham. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Operator, can we stop the recording? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may disconnect your lines at this time.